Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zierer, and on this show, I speak to creators and folks who work around the creator economy about the craft and business of being a creator and what that even means. Today, we're speaking with Jesse Feister, Executive Director of the Webby Media Group. Jesse recently joined the organization after spending 4 years at Twitch, where he was the global head of creator marketing for 3 years. I should say I'm speaking to Jesse on Friday, April 10th, but this episode will be released on Tuesday, April 22nd, the same day the winners of the 29th Webby Awards will be announced. Jesse, thank you for being here.
Francis, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Okay, so you started at the Webby Group pretty recently, I think just a couple months ago. What is your mandate coming in? What is your remit?
So yeah, I'm about 3.5 months in. I started in January. So still sort of learning a lot. It's a iconic brand. It's been around. We're on our 29th year. So I have a lot to learn, but I also didn't come in sort of cold. I knew the Webbies really well, had been following the Webbies almost my entire career, was involved with a Webby nominated project about 5 years ago. Did not win, but was nominated. So I had that taste of...
I was honored last year, I feel you.
Yeah, you know the feeling. So for me, really, the mandate is at a high level ushering the Webbies into the next era, right? Like it's a brand that has been very important to how the internet, I think, has evolved. You know, we've always been supporting innovation and creativity as the internet evolves and as formats and ideas sort of come to market. We're usually ahead of the curve in sort of embracing and accepting and recognizing these sort of new ways of creating, usually before the traditional, you know, players might get behind them. Mm-hmm. An example that I just heard recently, but it's a good sort of example of sort of how the Webbies step into the space. I mean, it's not that long ago where it was actually like very controversial for Jimmy Fallon to be putting content on YouTube, yeah. Right? I'm sure it was like a huge deal for NBC and how they talked about it. And, you know, the Webbies jumped on immediately. Like, this is sort of like how it's going to be. We need to be recognizing these formats. And so Jimmy Fallon was like, I think, person of the year that year, in part because of sort of how he was able to jump in and take what he did into the internet earlier than a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Blogs, newsletters. I mean, these are all sort of things that we take for granted now, but there was a time where they just were not considered to be legit. It was interesting, but it wasn't like a real format. And so there's always been this space because of the way technology evolves, because of the way the internet sort of brings new ways of connecting with people to the world fast, where there's sort of this space for legitimacy to be built. And I think the Webbies have played a really important role in sort of making sure that these new formats get the credibility they deserve and sort of acts as a bridge to more sort of traditional mainstream entertainment and media community. Yeah.
So I've been, you know, aware of the Webbies probably about 15 years or so when I was going into college and studying digital media. I can't recall exactly, but for me, it always has been this like legitimizing body within the bounds of the internet. Why was this edition, the 29th edition? I know this predates your joining too, but if you can speak to why this was the right year to create a dedicated group of awards specifically for creators.
Yeah. So I inherited these choices in some ways, but I completely not only support them, but I think it's a really big part of why I am here. Mm-hmm. Is I think the very clearly creators, this sort of format is becoming not just sort of a way to distribute content. It's not just like, oh, you can post a video on social media, but the actual format of being a creator has sort of reached a peak where it makes sense to sort of define and clarify what excellence is and start to put some, some definitions around what excellence looks like in this space. And I think the pandemic was this moment where it just exploded, where people mm-hmm. really, really quickly figured out how to use the platforms. There were people watching. And so a couple of years later now, the formats are sort of mature enough that it really makes sense for them to be their own distinctive category for the Webbies. Again, we've been recognizing creators for years across different categories. We've had like social media categories. We have podcast categories, even video and film. So it's not like this is like a brand new space for us, but we've never really made the distinction of saying like, this is actually a format that is sort of deserves its own lane so that the work that's being done can sort of be judged along the merits of what it's doing, what the format itself is now.
Yeah. So I think this isn't a question, but I think it is worth stating. One of my ongoing projects with this series is to define the word creator in a broad sense, because I think it has a specific meaning on every given social media platform, right? And it originates on YouTube, creators on YouTube. A creator on YouTube is a little different from a creator on Instagram, et cetera. I'm interested in like, what's the connection? What's the broad sense? And I think that the Webbies now have this distinct category. There's a definition there too. But to that point, there are 8 parent categories in the Webby Awards, including creators now. And I'll read the other 7. There's websites and mobile sites, video and film, advertising, media and PR, apps and software, social, podcasts, and AI, immersive, and games. And so what's interesting to me about this is a lot of those other ones are specific types of media, which like creators have websites,
right.
They make video, they do social, but they're not all, you know, just specific types of media. Like advertising, media, and PR is also kind of a more general one, which maybe when I see that, maybe that's separate from creators in that that represents like organizations doing advertising, media, and PR work, as opposed to creators, which are maybe more independent. And I'm pretty sure a friend of mine has a, I think it's under the social category, but it might be under advertising, media, and PR, a video nominated. It's currently winning. It's like, and within that, there's multiple creators. There's Kareem Rama, who does Subway Takes. There's the Rizzler. You have Taylor Lorenz, who's this kind of creator journalist. You have New York Nico. And so this is a company bringing together multiple creators for a social media video that is an advertisement. So the categories start to get blurry as they do. On the internet. Yeah. But I guess my question here is like more specifically the thinking behind some of the creator categories restructured, which I'll give you one more thing actually before we get there. So it's split into 2 subcategories. There are the 12 individual creator categories, which are split into genres like comedy, food and drink, and sports. And then there are the 11 creator excellence categories, including best editing, best long form video, best series. So that for the listeners, kind of a way these are structured. But yeah, my question is how the Webbies then define creators as opposed to any of these other 7 categories.
Sure. So I think we have a definition that I'll sort of speak to. I think we can talk a little more broadly too.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like it's a word that means everything and nothing. It can. So the definition is really important. I know that that's like a passion point of yours, but I agree with you. But I think there's a couple ways to look at it. So our definition, honoring outstanding content made exclusively for social platforms by creators and influencers. So it is more about the individual, or at least the nature of the individual. Granted, there are examples where brands are sort of playing in that space with collectives, but the difference is it's like an individual bringing their work to market sort of unmediated or as unmediated as possible. I think that that's different from what you see on social, although the lines are certainly blurred. But there's a distinct sort of difference now between social media content and what an individual is doing sort of to bring their own creativity directly to an audience through a platform. And again, to your point, it varies depending on the service.
Yeah.
You have a very different type of creator live streaming versus what you might see in like a, you know, long form on demand content. But ultimately it's about recognizing the individuals and their contributions to bring their own creativity to market and to an audience.
Okay. That makes total sense to me. And I think of like, you know, the idea that like corporate personhood, right? Like corporations are people. This is almost like swinging in the opposite of that, like recognizing that one person can be a company and an organization within and of themselves. I think a great example that I've seen covered in a few places recently is Macy Gilliam at Morning Brew. She might even be up for a Webby. But she, I understand, recently signed a new contract with Morning Brew, where she has been doing work for them for maybe a couple of years now, social videos and these series, and she has developed as a personality there. But she just signed a new contract with them that her agent negotiated, where her compensation increases, and then she also gets a percentage of revenue generated from advertising on these shows, merchandise around them, whatever. So she's shifting from an employee to a creator, because she's kind of bearing the burden of pushing this thing forward, though she has resources, but she also gets the upside. And I think that's a definitive thing of a creator, is somebody who like has, you know, if not it's high ownership of the business.
Yeah, it's their own personal ownership over the brand. And it's, you're bringing yourself to the space in a unique way. And again, like, it's going to evolve. Like, I don't want to act as if we've like nailed the definition and it's not going to change. I think this is our attempt at sort of putting some structure around it. We're keeping really close eye on what comes through. Are we sort of like appropriately structuring these awards? Is there somewhere that we should change? We change the awards every year to kind of reflect the feedback that we get from the community and sort of how the space that changes. So, but I do think that there's just become a distinct difference between what used to be social content and what now is much more around an individual sort of entrepreneurial contribution to that content, and how their own self-expression is sort of being not just brought to the creativity, but it's like essential to what is actually ending up being consumed.
Hey, if you're enjoying this conversation, consider subscribing to the podcast. We release a new episode every Tuesday. All right, back to the show. So I want to move to your background for a little while. So you have early roots as a musician, and then you go to Wharton, you get an MBA, and we'll go back as far as that in a little bit. But I'm more interested in your most recent role, which was at Twitch.
Sure.
As I referred to at the beginning, you were the global head of creator marketing for 3 years, and you were at Twitch for 4 years total. I believe right before that you were in charge of music marketing in particular. Tell me about that switch from like music marketing specifically into starting to think about creators and formally working on the creator economy.
Yeah. So I came to it's all about the pandemic. I think the pandemic will be this like critical.
You joined
moment.
Twitch like right around the start of the pandemic.
Right at the start of the pandemic. Yeah. And there was this influx of musicians who were all at home and needed a way to sort of connect with their fan bases, and streaming was such an obvious thing for musicians to do. And it was still is an early format. Like, you can of course stream yourself performing, but there's a lot more to live streaming than just like playing a concert. That's all about interaction and community, and you know, having a back and forth with chat is really the core piece of Twitch. So I came initially to help the music category grow, to help kind of bring the musicians who were already on Twitch into sort of a space where they could grow on Twitch and get the most from it. And it was a explosive time. It was awesome to see. We brought everybody in the world streamed on Twitch over the course of that couple of years. Some of it really retained. Some people went back out on tour when the world opened up and used Twitch maybe intermittently. But what I sort of realized when I came into Twitch, and I knew a little bit about gaming and live streaming, but I was really, my expertise was in music. But to your point, my experience as a musician, I did the DIY musician thing for years, like 10 years. We'll get into it.
You're assigned to labels. Yeah.
Signed to labels, all the different things you can do without getting rich or famous. I think I've done everything as a musician.
But that's why you get an MBA.
Yeah. Eventually you're like, okay, I gotta get my life together. Yeah. But the thing that I was pleasantly surprised at Twitch to see the kind of core creator. And I really, really, resonated with me, that entrepreneurial creator. Yeah. I said, I may not understand every single game on Twitch, but what I do get is that these are people who are creative and they have a dream of sort of like getting into their own world. And they're going to just get up every day and work hard and sort of stream and grind and try to take themselves from where they are today to like whatever their dream is.
Yeah.
And I just got that. I was like, that makes sense to me. If nothing else,
pull themselves up by their guitar strings.
Yeah. It's very similar to we're going to go out and book shows. Like, for me, it was a MySpace era. Mm-hmm. And I just really connected with the grind of what these Twitch streamers were going after and how important it was to their identity and how it's just like a really, really important experience for people to have. So I think that that sort of allowed me to step into the broader creator role appropriately. Mm-hmm. It was like, I'm not going to be the expert on every single game, but that's not really what live streaming is about. It's about creators wanting to sort of express themselves in different ways.
It's a relationship between the person and
connect
chat.
Connect with an audience. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it was more than anything, it was that journey of sort of that entrepreneurial journey. And I really framed a lot of my work in creator marketing around that. Like, how do we help people who are really going after careers in the creator economy get the support they need, understand what they're up against, but also what the opportunities are in appropriate ways, and ultimately monetize to the extent that they can make a living, right? That's always the goal, is like, how do you get someone into the place where they can do this full time? There's a bigger conversation around that, right? Is that right for everybody? Is that sustainable? For some, certainly, but for many, it becomes sort of a hobby. And there's all sorts of value in between, mm-hmm. right? You can get a lot out of the experience. But I had a great time working with these live streamers, and I found that I had way more in common than them than I thought I would, because it was the same grind. I was like, oh, yeah. I get it. You're going for it, and I love that. So
Okay, there's a lot of threads I want to get into here. But first, I am curious about your background as a musician. So I think one story I'll give right before I hand it over to you. I don't know if you're familiar with the musician, YouTuber, creator Andrew Huang, who I interviewed him. Yeah, I interviewed him about a year ago on the occasion of the publication of his book, Make Your Own Rules, which is kind of a memoir and a bit of a guide of like being a musician on the internet and making a living doing that. And he, like 20 plus years ago, maybe now, he got to start. Now, he's never had a proper job. He was selling his songwriting services on eBay when that was like the only way it would make sense to do it. He gets on YouTube. He grows there over the years, et cetera. But so while he's doing this and selling his songwriting services on YouTube and you know, he's doing some live shows, et cetera, you are hacking it out there, touring, et cetera. So tell me, and it's the MySpace era. So tell me about your experience as a musician and how that kind of grows into like you gaining an understanding of business.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, Midwest, very, very much a place where you're not really supposed to go try to be a musician. Although there are many great creative people that come out of Ohio. It's not really like people are like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. You should go try to be
a
musician.
It's the heartland.
It's like, get a real job, do something that actually works. But the internet was for me, like the opening that was not there prior. I was old enough to, I downloaded Napster when I was 16. It was like, this is a whole new world. I got access to all of this music that I never would have had before. And it sort of ended up breaking and reshaping the music industry. And there's an interesting conversation around that. But at the time I was like, this is just amazing and it's free. And the step right past that was you could start to discover and connect with musicians who were making music all over the world pretty quickly. And so I think what was formative for me was the idea that you could, instead of just having to go get a record deal and like send a demo out, you could put music up on the internet. It was MySpace. It was pure volume. And you could just go out and start connecting with fans directly and try to build an audience that way. And we did it, right? To a certain extent, I moved to Chicago. That was like the MySpace was in its absolute sort of peak. MySpace had a record label for a minute. We were signed there and then it fell apart. So I've been, you know, all the different platforms.
I actually wasn't aware that MySpace had a record label, which is kind of a really interesting, like early way of like a social platform making some kind of creator program.
Right. It was probably one of the early creator programs when you think about it. But it was very, very sort of formative for me because it wasn't just like make music and help have someone market you and make you famous, but you have control. Like you are in the driver's seat. The more you do, the smarter you are. The more you understand about not just making music, but also all of the other things around that, like that's actually going to impact your success trajectory. So it's also hard, right? You have a dream. You're up against everyone in the world telling you it's like not a good idea.
What were you? What was your band? How many people was it?
So I was a drummer.
Okay.
So I had, and I played in a number of different bands over the years, from like rockabilly to pop punk to like radio pop. But the experience for me was really all about DIY, building a fan base from the ground up. And the fact that I was not in a big music market, I think forced that upon us. And, you know, I ended up with a record deal with Island Records, which was like immediately not the right thing, but it felt, you know, I was able to go home on Thanksgiving and tell my family that I had a record deal.
Legitimizing force.
Right. After like 5 years, I'm like, they don't know what you're doing. They're like, what are you doing? Like, you're on MySpace. Like, you have fans. We don't know what this means. But something about having a record deal, everyone was like, oh, you've done it. I'm like, actually, it was the beginning of the end, because as soon as we signed the record deal, we were within a year shelved and stuck. And that's a whole different story. But many bands later, it was sort of time to move on. I didn't go straight back to business school. I actually jumped into the startup ecosystem in Nashville, which was small, but there was a lot of overlap with the creative community. And I kind of got into a startup. I got a sense of how people build products. And then I launched a music company with some friends around basically accessing unrecorded music in the cloud. It was like that time. Spotify came to market. Everybody had music on hard drives. And all of a sudden, anyone who had like 10 years of unreleased music needed to have that music accessible to them in the cloud. And so we built a platform around that idea, eventually used by a bunch of the different music companies around the world. And we had a small exit. And anyway, I stayed in music for years past that. But it was always about the internet allowing new ways of doing things, whether it was files, you know, being able to collaborate faster, to Spotify bringing all sorts of new ways of getting music and reaching fans.
So, so I want to talk about the general artist to business pipeline. I know this is something you're passionate about. You co-authored a piece on this in the Harvard Business Review last year, where it was you and two others, and I don't know, collectively you interviewed 150 people who started their lives in creator careers before joining the traditional labor market. And you identify three skills that are very valuable to be translated from creative work to business work, which are a growth mindset, a bias for innovative action, and intrinsic motivation. So tell me more about this, like this jump and how you've seen it work for other people, your theories of it.
So I ended up working in all sorts of startups and business, and sort of, I always felt that everything I'd ever done as a creator, as a musician, was like directly related to me doing anything in the world. I felt it so strongly that those experiences were like who I was and why I was able to like get stuff done and why I was, you know, motivated in the way that I was. But it was almost impossible to explain that to someone else. They're like, if you don't have that experience, you're like, well, wait, how does being a musician have anything to do with you being a startup
manager
or a product person? And so I realized I wasn't alone. I met a friend, the person I co-authored the paper with, who had studied at Berklee School of Music, and he had gone into something completely outside of entertainment. He worked in healthcare innovation. And he was like, dude, if you think you have a problem telling people what you do, imagine me. I'm with doctors and financiers all day, and they just they don't take what I've done seriously at all. And yet we both felt that this was really core to how we were able to succeed as professionals. So we thought it was interesting. We found a professor at Wharton who had tried to be in a band for a while as well. And he's like, I get it. I can help you structure this research. And we went out and found 150 people who had sort of similar backgrounds. And again, like in the creator economy, I think the insight was, look, we were musicians. This has always been a thing. You grind, you figure yourself out. And those experiences can be really valuable in professional settings if you sort of know how to bring them to the table the right way.
Allow me to give you another of my theories for a second. So it's something I've been workshopping, this kind of horseshoe theory of agency. So in the middle of the horseshoe, right, low agency, you're not doing much. On the opposite ends, on one side is like the DIY artist, the punk, the techno DJs throwing warehouse raves, right? And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the people starting tech startups, et cetera. You know, the kind of you can just do things tech startup culture versus DIY music and art culture. And I think I'm still workshopping this, but if there's a difference, like either way you go from the center, you're getting higher agency, but one side is maybe more like art and like social focus, and the other side is more like commerce profit focused. And again, maybe flawed, and just, you know, it's a spectrum, whatever. But what you're kind of talking about is like how people jump the horseshoe, the space between the ends of the horseshoe.
Absolutely. And so, big picture, there was a lot of people doing this for years. The creator economy is new, but the creative sort of experience is not. But now you're going to have 100 times more people who had this experience that we had. And our insight was like, let's go figure out what works, because there's going to be a lot of people who decide at some point that for whatever reason, they want to do something else with their lives, even if they've been really successful. There's going to be plenty of creators who don't want to do at 30 what they wanted to do at when they were 20. And that's completely reasonable sort of way to evolve. But you're going to need to make sense of your experience and be able to bring that into the next phase of your career. And we had struggled with it. It's not just like, oh, I know how to do things. You also have an identity crisis because you thought you were a musician, but now you're in another setting. So we went back and talked to 150 people who had comparable experiences across the arts, right? It wasn't just musicians. It was everyone from artists to filmmakers to really anyone who you might fit the definition of like a creator, entrepreneurial creator. And we analyzed their professional experience and talked to them about how they thought they succeeded. These are now CEOs, product managers, people who are sort of established professionally. And those, to your point, that we found a couple common themes. What did you figure out through your creator experience? What did you develop that then you've been able to bring with you to your professional life? And all of them, interestingly, not a single, everyone says, this is why I succeeded. Because I had this early experience, because I really figured myself out and developed these entrepreneurial skills, like that is why I was able to sort of be where I am today. And they also were like, yeah, I never can explain it to anyone. So we're like, all right, we're onto something, because people, we're not alone. And it's the, you know, you said pursuit of a personal vision. It starts there. Most people have this form. Most of the people we spoke to had this sort of like moment in their life where they're like, I am going to do this. I have a creative calling and I'm going to go out and start to take the sort of entrepreneurial steps necessary to make this happen. To, as we talked about earlier, I'm going to bring my own creative work to market in some way that's not just, I have more agency over the process. And learning through practice was the other one. Most people figure skills, they're able to kind of pick up new skills because you have to, right? You probably know how to edit videos now just because you're like, I want to get my ideas out into the world. And that's a mindset around skill development that not everybody has, because not everybody has to figure it out that way. And then finally, there was this idea of identity and work. People really, as a creator, you really identify with what you're doing in a way that's like you're intrinsically motivated. And so those sort of values translated into business speak pretty neatly, where you ended up having, you know, a bias for innovative action. Well, that's basically just pursuit of a personal vision. Like it's just a different, it's a different language for the same thing.
Yeah.
Learning through practice is really about a growth mindset. Buzzword in the corporate community, growth mindset. We all want growth mindsets. Well, every creator in the world has one, because they have to figure out how.
You got to find your audience.
You got to figure out how to do it, right? You're going to figure out how to do the things you need to do to make it happen. And then identity and work is really just intrinsic motivation. And so we were like, this is beautiful. All of these things that we kind of couldn't articulate are like famous business buzzwords that every company in the world is seeking. Yeah. Every company
on the values list.
We are looking for a bias for innovative action, growth mindset. It's like literally out of the job descriptions that you read everywhere. And we're like, well, this is what you learn as a creator. You become this person, but the language isn't necessarily there for everyone. So the goal of this sort of research and this work is to help give creative entrepreneurs a language to talk about their experience, so that when they do decide to, if and when they do decide to sort of evolve, that they can have continuity in that experience. It's not like I did this thing and now I do something else. Well, you're always going to have yourself, and you're going to bring yourself to whatever you do. And that experience you build as a creator is, in my experience, core to everything else you're going to do, but you need to be able to explain it to people.
I totally agree. It's just a language thing, and it's not like you just have to understand some of these business lingo terms.
We're like, everyone's writing books on these ideas, but like we're down here in grinding it out and actually learning it the hard way. Like, let's get some credit for,
and that's what matters
for it. So it's been awesome to put it out. We had so much inbound response from people saying like, this is me. I never had the language. There's also an important aspect around the identity crisis, because I think it's really common, at least for me. It's like, I was a musician. Like, that is everything I was. Like, I define myself as a music person. And that's like how I sort of, the story I told myself was that. And I think that many creators are the same way. You're like, I've sort of defined myself around the work that I do.
Yeah.
And the unlock, I think, from what we found and what I found is, it's not that your work is who you are, but you bring yourself to your work. So as long as you define yourself as sort of below the work you're doing, you can bring that same self to a lot of different domains and still be sort of authentic.
Yeah.
It's not that I'm a musician. I'm just a person that likes to make things.
To engage in the world.
Yeah. And so I can do that in various different ways. So I can express myself in different areas of life and still be the same person. And that was sort of an unlock that we found as well.
Yeah. No, I love that. Were there any people, whether of those 150 people you spoke to, or maybe when you were at Twitch and working with creators, like particular creator business models, which I say that I'm like, well, what is a creator business model? I guess it's somebody who, as we, you know, who's producing and distributing digital media as a core part of their work. But any specific creator business models you've seen that are really strong or sustainable, or they don't have to be like, you know, this person's making millions, but like this person's making a sustainable living.
I think there are a couple different levels to it. Mm-hmm. When you're smaller, if you're just getting started, or if like that kind of like niche stage, I think what's really different now than maybe 10 or 15 years ago was the capacity to sort of monetize a small community is just fundamentally different. Like Patreon didn't exist. Twitch was very much about individual.
Patreon, also something founded by a musician by music.
Jack is a great example of a creative entrepreneur. I'm sure he would, you know, he definitely fits that mold.
Yeah.
And so I think monetizing a community early and building, being able to sort of keep a core group of people really, really engaged, and using the monetization tools that are now available to sort of sustain that is available now in a way that it wasn't 10 years ago. I think that that's great. I think it also requires a lot of work. It's sort of this like ongoing grind that you have to sustain to keep the monetization happening, but it's also there. It didn't used to be, right? You could have a big audience or a sustained audience, but how are you going to monetize them? For us as musicians, it's like, well, maybe we can sell them t-shirts every month, but like you can't sell a t-shirt every month.
Fan How clubs, were you making money when you were a musician? Was it the label fees and merch and touring? Just that?
It was almost all touring.
Yeah.
And it's not a ton of money, but
how big was the band too? How many
years were splitting it? Right. Well, it went from 5 to 4, so it got a little bit easier. But you know, like you play shows where you get paid, certain shows you get paid more, you just sort of figure out how to make it work. And then you would sell CDs, and like we sold downloads. It was just like a really messy time. It was like no one was making any money in music. It was probably the actual dip of the music industry.
Yeah, well, maybe the worst time.
The historic dip actually like is like exactly when I was right in the middle of it as a musician. But so I think like monetizing a small community, that's something I saw at Twitch that I was sort of fascinated by. You have a lot of people who are not famous. They're not huge. They're working really hard, and they're doing something really well, but they were able to monetize through subscriptions and just creating sort of ongoing content that delivers. I mean, like Substack's another version of that. Yeah. That's now a thing now that didn't used to exist. But it's got this grind associated with it that I think a lot of people, I believe it will be hard for many people to sustain that forever. So the second, you know, the trend that I've seen, which is a little bit trickier, but I think as you grow, and what I've seen that's really interesting is being able to sort of take the insights from your audience, because you're so intimately sort of aware of what you're doing and who the people that you're serving care about, what their needs are, all the things you might want to know about a market. You can really understand products or services that would fit that that audience particularly well. And the jump out of the hamster wheel is to figure out how to build a product, service, or brand that uses those insights that you were uniquely able to glean because you know that audience so well, but then build a product that you can sort of step out of. So I am going to kickstart this product with my audience, and my insights are going to be the core for like building it.
Okay, wait. So this is something I want to jump in on. Yeah. So another idea I've been workshopping, the idea that the creator economy is not necessarily a distinct industry as such, but a term we will in 20 to 30 years use to refer to this disruptive era where, like you said, when you were, you know, working as a musician, it was maybe the worst time because this was when so many institutions were really starting to crumble, and ways of working and ways of doing business were changing because of the internet, right? Whereas now, over the past decade or so, these new ways of working and engaging with audiences and making money through the internet have been forming. But I think even as a bunch of legacy businesses kind of struggle or crumble or shutter or adapt, these new businesses are growing. Like Mr. Beast is always a classic example, right? But I think like in over the next 20, 30 years, really even much shorter, over the next 5 to 10 years, a lot of these new media businesses will formalize, will grow large, will have hundreds to thousands of employees, yeah. Whatever. And it's like, I wonder if, you know, the ease of entry into digital media is going to it's going to be harder again, or if it will be a continual disruption and that's what the creator economy is. But yeah, my theory is maybe that like we are in a period right now that will not last forever. That is just a reshuffling of power that like in 20, 30 years again, it might've crystallized and be harder to enter again.
I think that's probably true. And also two things can be true at the same time. So a book I will recommend is The Master Switch. It's Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia. He worked in sort of like internet policy for the Biden administration, but it just puts the whole internet into context of like all the other media cycles and how there's always this like magical moment where a new technology comes to market. It's this like explosion of utopian creativity and anything's possible. And then eventually the cycle is such time after time that there's consolidation that sort of eventually becomes monopoly. And then it just starts over again. Yeah. So I think that that's a really real thing, and it's already probably happening. But at the same time, it's not that it's going to go back to normal, right? You're going to have a new structure that will evolve from where we are today. And I do think it's kind of what I was getting. That's kind of what I think where I was going and what you were kind of picking up on is building brands and products is going to really change because you have the insight of the audience at your fingertips in a small way. You can basically test through feedback cycles what works quickly and cheaply, and then scale it if it's good. And the key is that like stepping away from the hamster wheel. So the brand needs to then be able to sort of take a life of its own. And that's what you see with Mr. Beast or even like Skims or Prime. You know, have all sorts of issues with the pause, but Ohio. So,
yeah.
But you know what I mean? Those are like you walk into CVS and there's just now a product that you've heard of. You don't really necessarily know where it started, but how it started is very, very different than how it would have 10 years ago. So I do think that that's like a trend that's not going away, but I agree with you at the same time that it's a cyclical evolution and consolidation is inevitable.
Well, this is also, Slow Ventures just launched like a month or two ago now, a $60 million creator fund where like maybe I'm misunderstanding some of it, but as I understand it, they are just looking to invest in product companies started by creators. And like the innovation there is simply that these creators have these large built-in audiences. So the theory is it'll be easier to stand up a new business because they have this distribution and loyalty.
Yeah. I think what's missing in that is also the insight, the audience insight too. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, oh, you have like an audience, therefore you can sell them something. You know what to sell them because
what
you
are.
You are like intimately aware of what that community or what that like part of the market really, really needs and cares about. And that is a unique new reality that is, you know, you do market research. You have people who spend time trying to figure this out scientifically, or you have someone who just lives it and breathes it and knows everything about this community so intimately that they just know what products are going to work.
It's priced in.
Right. I think you're going to see a lot more of that. I think that that's fundamentally different way of product development. But I also think that eventually there's a point where the brands just reach mainstream, penetration. And people are just like, well, I just got this energy drink. I don't really know who's behind it, but now it's here. And I've heard of it.
I just saw it next to Gatorade or whatever. Okay. Something about the new technology bit too. You were talking about a second ago. You recently wrote a piece about AI and creativity. Something I took away from that I've been thinking about is that, you know, there's all the fear mongering about AI taking creative jobs, but you don't see so much about like, well, creative entrepreneurs, creators can actually be empowered to like not need as many maybe business consultants or strategists to help them do it. Like there's not much talk about like flipping that and like AI, like actually empowering creators by giving them the knowledge, like, you know, democratizing creativity, whatever, let's say. Yeah, but yeah. What it does do is democratize business strategy and like the ability to execute like a marketing plan, right?
Right. And the ability to, I mean, again, like you, there's different ways to look at it. So people are afraid AI is going to sort of replace creativity, which I don't believe. I think that if anything,
it just makes it more valuable.
It makes it more valuable. However, ask a creator if they do stuff that they don't like doing.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a, like a litany of things that are really tedious and not really the core value. And there's a lot of low hanging fruit to just use AI. Like from what I can see is just like a lot of things are going to probably become easier to do, which is good. And that also means that more people are going to be able to participate in the system because it just takes less effort to actually enter it. But you're still competing on your core creativity. Like, what do you have to bring to the table at your core? Like, can you connect with another human being? Can you connect with multiple human beings? I do not think that AI disintermediates that. I think if anything, it's just, it's more likely to get down to the competition based on the best sort of creativity.
Well, I think it goes back to agency. And like, if you're in the middle of that agency horseshoe and you're not going to do much, like, you know, I'm very aware of
this. Your horseshoe. It's a good one.
Thank you. I'm still workshopping it, but no. So like, you know, if you, I'm very well aware that like a lot of what I put out is this like advice that, you know, asking creators, how did you do this? How did you do that? Whatever. And people aren't always willing to share. They're not always willing to give up like the tactic they use to make this video go viral, whatever. But I'm always like, I think they're misunderstanding what the giving away the sauce, because the sauce isn't necessarily the tactic. It's the agency. And that's the barrier. That's the thing, is maybe AI can put people who are more high agency much further ahead and leave the lower agency people in the dust.
And that is definitely disruptive, but it's not something to fear if you value creative judgment and you think that that's like your core asset. If creative judgment is what you think is what is driving value, and it's what I think really matters personally, then the technology just becomes a means to an end to do it more effectively. Of course it will change. Of course it's not going to look the same that it looked as it looked 5 years ago, but creative judgment is about connecting with other people. And I think that insight is like timeless and was just not going to be replaced by technology. However, if you do something that doesn't require creative judgment, and that's a really big part of how you make a living, it is a risk, right? So I do understand the fear, but I still think that it's better to have more people being able to use their creative judgment to create value in the world, because that's what value is.
I love that. Yeah. Okay. Going back to the creator economy a little bit. So there are increasingly a number of businesses built around creators, not creators themselves, but strategists, managers, agents. We're just talking about the VC side of it. In as much as you are across this industry, where do you think are the most underserved areas or the biggest opportunities for like new businesses or services to pop up?
It's a good question. I'm going to say some that come to mind. I'm sure if others will come to mind later. But the one that I think that the tediousness of the creative process and like just the pure amount of effort that goes into creating, managing, and tracking content is, and I saw this in music, so I think I've built products around these problems.
Creative operations. I used to work at a company where we made a product for that.
Yeah. It's still a pain. It's not that easy, right? It still takes a lot of tedious effort. And so I see that, I think maybe just as someone who's been in it, I'm like, man, I don't want to do those things. I want to focus on being creative or doing something that really matters and using my judgment. So I look to that first. Like, I would love for it to be, the easier it becomes to sort of manage the creative process, I think that's always going to be valuable.
Project managers.
Yeah. I think that like financing and funding of creativity and creators is interesting. I think it's also kind of misunderstood in the sense that your music is sometimes used as like an analogy, like, oh, well, there's record labels, maybe there should be creator, some sort of like equivalent model. But there's a really difference. There's a pretty big difference in what IP is sort of generated. And with music, like the rights, the music, the songs or recordings themselves sort of live on. Whereas for a lot of creator content, while there is IP that sort of lives out in the world, I think it's a little more ephemeral, and the value of that content over time is less clear. Maybe that'll change. So I think when people think about, oh, we should just give record label models to, which is a terrible idea to begin with, because like, have we ever seen how bad record labels are? I would say record deals can be very bad. as someone that's lived it.
They can be prisons.
It's also a fundamentally different sort of investment. So like you have to continue to grind for that investment to pay off. And you're like investing in a person that you don't know where they're going to be in 5 or 10 years. I just don't think it's healthy to like lock people in to something where they have to keep doing the same thing over and over again. So I don't know. I think that financing of creators will evolve, but I think it's, and I think there's opportunities there, but I also think it's delicate and it's going to require people that really understand actually what it is to be a creator.
Yeah. So I'm really curious. I don't know much about the state of music creators. Like I mentioned, I interviewed Andrew Huang last year. I interviewed another guy called Andrew Southworth, who he helps people like marketing their music and, you know, getting cracking Spotify charts, etc. But I'm not really up on the state of music creators. But I'm curious, the Jesse of 20 years ago, if you were 20 years younger and you were trying to hack it as a musician, where would you start? What would you be doing to find success?
I think the biggest change, and this is not just for music, but this is what I think is settled now in a way that wasn't settled. The access to feedback cycles is just like fundamentally different. Like you can put something out and immediately get a sense of whether it's resonating or not. And that as a musician in, you know, 2008, 2010, 2012, you would like sit and just like argue over whether the, like, well, people are going to like this or they're not going to like it. And like, you could spend like months and months before you put anything out. And then you kind of were committed to it. Whereas now, and I think this is what's happening in music, like people are really able to put music out quickly and get a sense of whether it's reacting or not. And that's amazing because it really gives you a directionally insight onto like, is this going to work or not? But it also like kind of risks the intuition, the artist's intuition. And so there's no easy answer for how to make choices like this. But I think you have to take the market feedback into consideration. You have to take advantage of the fact that you can get insights as to whether what you're doing is working. But if you have an artistic point of view and you feel very strongly that this is true, the best music in the world sometimes takes time to reach the right audience. And you can't take market feedback as like a binary good or not, but you also can't ignore it. So yeah. I would be spending a lot of time trying to understand what was reacting, but I'd also probably still be having similar arguments with my bandmates about whether it was really good or not.
That's such a good point. Like the decisiveness, and this goes back to what we were talking about with like AI and creatives and creativity, where it's like, you still need to know, you have to have the decision-making. You have to know when to say no to a thing, when to say yes. You have to have a good judgment for what's good, what's not. And I think about like 10 years ago, I think it was when the Kanye West album Life of Pablo came out and he was like updating songs live. And then Charlie XCX last year, she like all of her last past albums now, the album art has been updated in the same style as Brat. And like you can now like reverse pretty much any, I mean, maybe not any, but so many of these decisions that you make creatively, and that, you know, that brings its own, like we can argue for another hour whether that's a good thing. It doesn't really matter. It's what the reality is now.
It is what it is. Yeah. So it's, the feedback cycle is real. Market feedback is valuable. You can't let it get in the way of your intuition. I wish there was an easy roadmap for how to make that decision, but if there was, you know, it wouldn't be such a esoteric, serious question. So for music in particular, I see that as like the biggest opportunity. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing it sort of change the music industry pretty much over the last 5 years. Like people know if something's working much, much, much more quickly. And that sort of changes the nature of how you build a music career.
There you go. Last question. I'm not sure how much you could answer this, but next year is the 30th Webby Awards. Is there anything you can speak to about plans for that or how the creator category evolves?
It's still early. We got to get through this year. So, we announce winners April 22nd, which is today
if you're listening
in podcast time. And then the ceremony itself is on May 12th. But I think what I can say for sure is that we are making a huge, we will be continuing to embrace the creator world in more meaningful ways. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but it's a core part of my vision for where the Webbies go. And not just because it's a trend and it's a big deal, because I actually think it's what
culturally
is
important.
It's what's changing the internet. And I also think there's like a real opportunity and value to be added. So I think that legitimizing people who are not taken seriously, I think maybe because of Twitch, people game like, how is that a thing? And they're like, no one understood it. And I'm like, yeah, this is a real thing that's impacting the world. And these are actually really, really credible, creative people who are doing something at a very, very high standard. So I think that there's just so much room to legitimize these formats still. And because the Webbies sort of have this credibility and are respected across the traditional, you know, landscape in some ways, I think we can really help bring those formats into a place where they're taken more seriously and respected. I think everyone acknowledges them, but I don't think everybody actually fully respects what's happening yet. So I'm hoping that we can be a part of that solution.
I look forward to seeing it. This has been a great conversation, Jesse. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and listener, I will see you next week. This has been the Creator Spotlight Podcast.